maybe if we could just start with, if you have any recollections or specific incidences that occurred in your relationship with Lacaine.
Lots.
Actually, I can thank the fact that I have ever known Hugh Lacaine to my mother-in-law, because this good lady, after she heard that I had become interested in electronic music in 1957, which seems to be 100 years ago, she heard me say, well, no, I have to go to Cologne. I really have to visit this guy Stockhausen. And that was after I heard in the CBC, the Gesang der Jugendlinge. And I said, well, fantastic sounds. And also I heard some of his electronic pieces. And I said, well, that guy must have, a whole building full of incredible machinery. I just have to go there and see. So my mother-in-law says, well, yes, but there is a... there's a person in Canada who does that. I said, no, I can't believe that Canada electronic is impossible. she says, no, I just read in the Gazette yesterday that this man, she looked up the Gazette and said, yeah, Hugh Lacaine. I said, Hugh Lacaine, a funny name. Well, I decided to follow it up. So I went down to the physics department knowing that there is a man, Stu Marshall, rather great old man, there, and I knew that he had some contact with NRC, and so I asked him, well, do you know of a man, Hugh Lacaine? I expected him to say, Hugh Lacaine, never heard the name. You know, Hugh, sure, he's a good friend of mine. I worked together with him. He's a splendid fellow. Anyhow, he arranged, he eased my way to the first meeting with Hugh. I went to Ottawa. And there was this man, this huge man, in the middle of the summer it was, he was wearing a heavy sweater. And there was this big room with... and then lo and behold, there was an electronic music studio in 1957 in Canada. You wouldn't believe it. I said, well, that's incredible. And I had a very stimulating conversation with him, as much as I could call it a conversation, because I had a great difficulty of understanding the man. Have you ever known him?
Mm-hmm. I haven't myself.
Well, Hugh, there's an expression, someone being painfully shy, you know, these two words together. The impression was indeed painfully shy person. Not quite a giant, but almost. Very tall man, that time he was very corpulent, and he talked rather softly and talked away from you, and talked at a monotone and talked softly, and I had a really hard time understanding what he's talking about. Also, he talked in jumps. His mind, I realized his mind works so fast that for him to finish a sentence and conduct an ordinary discourse, totally unnecessary, and that he assumed that the mind of his interlocutor is similarly speedy, so he jumped, and I wasn't prepared, and also my knowledge of the field was so scanty that I really had a very hard time. I remember I left with a headache, exhausted, sort of, and very stimulated. And then I went to Cologne, and when I came back, I tried to set something up at McGill. I drew a complete blank from the physics department and from electrical engineering. So I went back to Hugh Lacaine, and he, together with the then director of the Antonov section of Radio and Electrical Engineering Division in 1958, indeed, late 1958, were very helpful. They arranged that I could come back in the summer of 59 and spend the whole summer working in the electronic music lab. Now, my idea was that I want to compose music. I really wanted to use this equipment. And by that time, of course, having come back from Cologne, where I visited in 58, I realized that Stockhausen hasn't got a building. He had really, something which is not more than a cubby hole. He had a room, but you see my office, but this, perhaps the size of his office was a different shape, but the size was of his studio was not larger than this small office. And there he had a few tape recorders, a few oscillators, a third filter, and an impulse generator that was there, a few loudspeakers. So I realized that that's a different kind of operation. And indeed, Hugh Lequin's lab at NLC looked very good to me indeed. Mm. So I went back in 59, and they invented for me the designation visiting scientist, which was a total joke. I never was a scientist, I'm not a scientist now. They even gave me some money, you wouldn't believe it, for composing music there as a visiting scientist. I got a few hundred dollars, which helped to pay the rent in Ottawa. And I was in business. Well, that's how my association with Hugh started.
When you, how much later than that did you start the studio at McGill?
The studio finally came to being at McGill in 64, in the summer of 64.
Okay.
Also with the help of the nursing.
Right. And you worked with Hugh on that installation? Or did
that's
he,
right.
He consulted
that's right.
That?
In fact, installation, it was made possible by cannibalizing Hugh's own setup in Ottawa. Yeah. He shed one of his tape recorders, and he gave us, they built for us a special purpose tape recorder, the third version, first being in Jerusalem, second in Toronto, and we had the third in Magia. He gave us a spectrogram apparatus, gave us an oscillator bank, 24 or 30 oscillators, gave us a tone mixture generator, gave a third filter bank, and also some empty racks, a pulse generator, which was just a Hewlett-Packard commercial thing. And later on, he gave us the second version of the
serial structure.
Right.
That came a few years later. McGill had no money for that at all. Later on, some monies became available to buy by another tape recorder. But I would say the bulk of the equipment was what was made by Hugh.
Hmm. And you used the spectrograph in the electronic composition number 3?
Yes.
Maybe you could. That's one of the most troublesome instruments in terms of its concept. It's difficult for people to figure out.
Yes.
What was going on? Maybe you could just describe how you used it.
Well, shall I say a bit about the principle of the instrument?
Sure.
Well, the instrument is a control instrument. It doesn't produce sounds by itself, but it does control whatever you put into that. Control in the sense, in a binary sense, in a two-way sense. It either lets through some sounds or it eliminates some sounds, doesn't let them through. And this principle of yes or no, I let it through or I don't let it through, can be controlled in a subtle way according to any rhythm you care to set up. Now, for the time being, it would be a good idea to consider the machine as a black box that does this. That's the function. You put a sound in it, and then you control while the sound exist in this machine in time, you control at which point this sound is let through the machine, allowed to sound, and when it's suppressed. The machine controls that function, the on function or the off function, by a moving paper roll on which the composer draws, and depending on whether one put something on the paper or one didn't put something on the paper, the sound gets through or the sound gets suppressed. So depending on the design, this function is indeed comes into being, the on or off function, the let through and suppress functions. Now, there is not a single channel, but there is a relatively large number of channels, I think 24 or 12, I don't remember exactly now. There are 12 channels or 24 channels that perform this function. And therefore, the composer who makes use of this machine has to provide a pattern of drawing for every one of these channels. So you can imagine what a pretty nice abstract drawing you can produce by working with India ink, by blackening a channel at a certain time, leaving it blank another time. I had a great time just from the point of view of visual art. I'm no artist, and my imagination, probably from the point of view of an artist, is very mediocre. But I enjoyed really the visual potential of writing on this paper in a sense. Now, I understand that the machine works with some photocells, which are very sensitive to light. There's a light shining on an array of photocells which are static. Over that static array of photocells moves the paper, which is at times blackened, at times not blackened. When the paper is black, the light is not allowed through, which does something to the photocells, activates the photocells. When the light comes through, the photocells are not activated in the same way, and the sun doesn't come through, or vice versa. I don't remember when the sound gets through, either when the light gets across or the light is impeded. So it's really an on-off machine in this sense. One can also control the speed by which the paper travels across this array of photocells. One can even reverse the direction, so one can produce a retrograde rhythm. One can even...
you could put it in upside down.
Upside down, in which case one will produce an inverted rhythm as far as the channels are concerned.
Mm-hmm. Was it responsive enough to pick up an envelope if you indicated that a gradual darkening or lightning?
It's a very good question, Jim. I asked this question from Hugh, and Hugh said, yes, indeed, the machine is designed, the photocells are designed in such a way that they respond to different hues of darkness. Black. And I, in my optimism, I went to the nearest stationery store and bought a whole collection of graphite pencils and India inks, and combining pencils with India ink, and I was imagining that probably I could produce scale of 7 degrees of hues, which would produce a scale of intensity which probably corresponds to pianissimo, piano, and so on, up to fortissimo. I even tried to work by blackening part of the track, hoping that I never really got a clear enough explanation from Hugh, except he thinks that it's responsive to these manipulations. But I never really got a worthwhile result. It was either on or not. And also, very often the damn thing crackled and produced all sort of extraneous noises. So it was very, very temperamental, and at one point I really decided that it's really an on-off machine as far as I'm concerned, and as long as it didn't crackle, I was happy, and sometimes could use it.
What do you use as a sound source?
I could use as a sound source, for example, a series of sine wave oscillators, which I could couple that to the sine wave oscillator bank. That allowed me to play on those static oscillators a little tune. The effect having been very, very similar to the output of a sequencer, except it was the pattern was not a repeating pattern, because the design didn't need to be a repeating design. If the design didn't, the rhythmic design didn't repeat itself, then the order of succession of those oscillators didn't repeat itself either. Also, one is able to activate none to all to any number of the oscillators available by this device. Whereas a sequencer, I think, one goes one after the other one.
Mm-hmm.
So, that's
good. That's the clearest explanation we've had of that.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember the specific application to the piece that you?
Well, I don't remember which part. Use this. Actually, I think I used the spectrogram apparatus principally for my fourth electronic piece, not so much for the third one. The third one, when I needed a succession of sine tones, and the third piece. As you might know, is made up entirely of sine tones.
Mm.
I used splicings. It was very, very painful. As you know, I recorded those sine tones separately, and I remember NRC, the carpenter shop, cut a huge piece of board. You call those artificial, not artificial, but plywood board, and they drove in a series of nails, and I numbered those nails, and I recorded loops of individual sine tones according to, well, not even loops, just lengths of tape, so hanging like ribbons, and then when I needed a certain frequency, I didn't have to kind of fiddle with the oscillator. I just had a whole array of frequencies hanging there on the board. So when I have a scissor like a clerk in a notion store, clipped a little bit of the of my storehouse of sine tones and spliced it up, and then I need another frequency, and then went again to the board, and then looked up. No, yes, that's number 17, and I clicked another. I mean, it was really kind of. Now, thinking of the all these secrets and computers, that was really a stone age of electronic music.
Yeah.
Did you work with the multi-track tape recorder?
Oh yes, now the multi-track tape recorder, as far as I'm concerned, was the most useful machine. I worked with, and I worked in every one of my pieces, including La Tour Angèle, in which the, I don't know whether you know this composition.
Yeah, I've heard that. That's
it's over here.
Yeah, it's one that we wanted to talk about.
So I mean, I have used that as recently as '74 in preparing the tape cards of this work. Now, as it turned out, and here I should come back to Hugh, and my glorious stay at NRC as a visiting scientist with huge double quotes. You see, NRC had its payoff. I composed, and they, for them, I was a guinea pig. For Hugh, I was a guinea pig. He was terribly interested, well, not terribly, he was interested, however, a real-life composer, and I think I was either the first or one of the first whom he could observe. I was almost there in a live composer, I could see how he works on a machine. No, I did anything with a machine except kicking them. I can thank Hugh for that. Hugh even showed me that if I take a pencil and hit the vacuum tubes on the Ampex tape recorder, these produce some very interesting sounds. So I was even hitting the vacuum tubes and produced some sounds which went into my second electronic composition. So in fact, some of the most interesting sounds were produced by hitting the vacuum with the pencil. I did, I mean, what I tried to do is the Ampex again, except kicking it. I was moving with hand the reels while the machine was stationary, or putting it on a fast wind, and I did anything which produced the sound. Now, the special purpose tape recorder, with its great flexibility for synchronization, I could synchronize up to 20 events. That was a marvelous machine, because until now, composing for orchestra, for example, is composing for a large number of instruments, I had to imagine these and I have to make sure that all the rehearsal time will be used in a proper way, and everything was terribly expensive when one. Everything is terribly expensive when one thinks ahead in composing for an instrumental ensemble or anything involving a very large number of people. But there, everything was incredibly cheap. Imagine, there were all these tape loops. Again, I like to work with tape loops, and I had a very large number of them. For example, for Cento, I had about 1,000 tape loops. And I cataloged them. So there were these many tape loops for also for electronic compositions 3 and 4. And there was this multi-track tape recorder. We called it multi-track. Mm. Officially called it special purpose tape recorder. Mm. Anyhow, that was a multi-track. And I could, of course, combine those dozens or hundreds of tape loops in any possible way. Now, you imagine how many ways you can combine even 36 tape loops, 10 at a time. Not only you take the first, seventh, 17th, or whatever, but you can put them in all sort of a phase relationship to each other. You can control the individual intensity. So the combinatorial possibilities are absolutely infinite. So I played orchestra there, and it was totally free. And I was absolutely staggered by the flexibility. I had my most, I shouldn't say most, but some of the most valuable compositional lessons ever by working through the night at the lab there at the National Research Council, showing to myself what would happen if I do this, what would happen if I would do that.
Yeah.
It was incredible. And I suddenly realized, among other things, that that the ceiling doesn't cave in if I pit two sounds which one would not have thought might fuse. But sometimes it didn't fuse, but the ceiling didn't cave in. I didn't have to pay $1,000. I didn't waste a half an hour rehearsal time. Right. It just was an experiment. And I first time I realized the exhilaration what a scientist feels that experiments with some materials, and who feels that he's allowed to make a mistake. As a composer who prepares for a rehearsal of a piece for a premiere, in our society, in our world, he's not allowed to make a mistake. Mm-hmm. If he makes a mistake, he runs the risk to be considered a dilettante, a waster of money of some commissioning organization.
Mm-hmm.
He must succeed. Not even a playwright as that. If somebody writes a play for a New York premiere, well, that play is sent first to Peoria. Does it play in Peoria or sent to Cleveland or Boston or whatever? Their composer very seldom has a second chance with a piece.
Yeah.
But there was not only a second chance, there was a hundredth chance. So I think that one of the great things for me with the multi-track recorder was, of course, to compose, but really the great thing was I felt a kind of freedom as a composer to experiment, the like of which I never had before.
Yeah, that's good. Could we talk maybe in some detail about Cento, about the way that piece was made?
Yes. Well, can I say something about how the whole work came about?
Sure.
And then I go back with you to the McGill Electronic Music Studio, which incidentally was considered by Hugh and by some other people the most scenically situated studio, because it was in a little stone coach house situated behind the then Faculty of Music building on Redpath Street in Montreal, one of those stately old houses that's where the Faculty of Music was, and it was smaller. And behind that there was a coach house, and that's what the university put at our disposal, a shell. And in its kitchen we set up the studio. But the kitchen is a difference, because it had a beautiful view into a lovely garden, a huge garden, where lilies grew and other flowers grew, and there was a nice huge lawn.
Yeah.
And so when one got tired of listening to sound tones, one only had to open the kitchen door and one was in the garden, rather than being in the basement or on top of a skyscraper. So it was beautiful. Anyhow, so you asked me about Cento. Well, the word Cento comes from, refers to this genre of poetry which is the assembly of a new poem from shreds of old texts. So in a way it's a collage.
Mm.
In music there are bits of Gregorian chant, plain chant, that are the results of centronization. And this composition is called Cento because its text is an assembly of fragments from a larger poem. And why I did that, and what's the poem is I'm coming to in a minute. But not only is this the this is not the only justification for the choice of the title. The word "cento," that is the process of centronization, also is operational at the level of composition. So there are two justifications. Now, coming to the text of Cento, the words I took from a large poem by the Canadian poet Eldon Greer, who agreed to this dismemberment of his poem. Now, why did I dismember a large poem, a large poem of his? Why didn't I take a ready-made poem by him or by another composer? Well, the objective was to write a piece for a small group called the University Chamber Singers, and of British Columbia. And the year was 1967, centenary year, where the whole existence of Canada was put in question by some political movements in Quebec, where I lived at that time in Montreal. And so when I thought of this piece, I said to myself, now, what way should young people make a vocal utterance in this day and age in Canada? Should they sing in a kind of bel canto way, or should they perhaps utter such sounds like Kathy Berberian utters in Berio sequences 3 or whatever? So I came up with a piece for spoken utterance, recitation, spoken recitation, and I needed a text. So I didn't find any poem. So I realized I have to assemble my own text. And I liked this poem of Erden Greer, and I assembled the text from words of this poem. So it is a poem made through the dismemberment of a larger poem. And I got the permission of the poet to use that. So here was then this product. What I did was then to get into the studio number of people, men, women, whom I asked to recite words, pairs of words, groups of words from this poem in a certain way. And I found myself not unlike a director of a radio drama that rehearses his actors. Only what I did is I rehearsed these people saying, well, could you please say that word this way or no, that way. And then it was a kind of give and take situation. I was lucky. I found, for example, a young woman who had a beautiful voice and who started to laugh by what I asked her. And I said, that's just a beautiful laughter. Could you laugh or could you perhaps dismember this word? And it was very much, I was inspired by what they did, and they responded to what I asked. And I came up with, as I mentioned a bit earlier, with a large number of tape loops, close to 1,000, which I had a list of. Again, those loops were hanging there on a rack. And then, with using of those loops, and mainly by using the special purpose tape recorder and its great capacity for synchronization, I experimented then through a very large number of ways how I could mix those spoken utterances. In fact, it was an exercise in applied phonetics, and I learned a great deal about language, how some sounds fuse or not fuse, and I could, one day I really probably I should speak about that. In fact, I have written an article which probably I can you probably know on the making of Cento, in which I go into that aspect, the experimentation aspect, a little bit deeper. But the story I never really said in its proper depth. It was a very instructive few weeks for me. Then I felt that I need some electronic sounds to make the tape as versatile as I felt it should be. So I generated some electronic sequences, which I then tried to mix with those spoken utterances. And assembling that, then I came up with the tape. And that was ready, and then I said, now I want to compose for 12 live vocalists, things which they can utter, recite, shout, whatever, that would complement the tape. And that was the second part of the composition, and the work is really the cooperation of a pre-recorded choir plus electronic sounds on the one hand and live choir on the other hand. And when the work is performed live, then what should emerge is just one homogeneous sound
mm.
that one should be able to tell apart what's on tape and what's the partner.
Is there a copy of that article that we could
yes,
get in?
Yes.
Okay.
I haven't seen it. I'd really like to
yes.
look at it.
Yes.
I wonder,
we should probably flip the tape before our next time.
Well, have you considered ways in which this your experience could be codified in some way and then made available to other composers in a learning situation?
Perhaps I can approach this very interesting question, Jim. The point of view, two different ways. First, as I recall, the development of the use of electronic music in curricula of those universities with which I have been associated with, or at least I knew of, McGill and Queens. And second, the systematic aspect to which you are alluding to. Well, when electronic music was an arcane art, very few people were allowed to or had access to studios. Studio directors it places kept their studios as elite installations, and a great deal of fuss was made about accessibility. People were asked about competence. The situation now is, of course, much healthier and much more democratic. Almost every self-respecting music department on this continent, at least, has a little electronic studio, or a middle-sized one, for that matter. And the development was relatively rapid, with the availability, commercial availability of instruments of various sorts. So I think this is all to the good, and this, of course, made certain things possible, which were not possible when Canada only had two studios, one in Toronto and one at McGill. Also, people associated with these early studios thought, well, no, this really is a different art, and it takes sophisticated people. Probably it's best to limit accessibility to graduate students. Also, yet another approach was on the part of the people who were very conservative, who didn't like the idea of electronic music at all. In fact, they thought this is not music at all. And they were objecting to the idea of quote-unquote contaminating innocent undergraduates by letting them touch an oscillator. Now, all that has changed. Electronic music became a medium for the good or the better, and of course there's no guarantee that any one composer or group of composers is going to produce worthwhile sounds with this medium, as there's no guarantee that a composer will produce a worthwhile bit of music with a Stradivarius violin.
Mm-hmm.
So, but anyhow, the fact is that today access to that sort of equipment takes place much more in a democratic fashion than it was the case as recently as 10 years ago, let alone 15 or 16 years ago when the Canadian studios, or 20 years ago when the Canadian studios came to being. Now, of course, this accessibility to equipment and the cheapness, relative cheapness of cost, of this equipment, which made this accessibility possible, at least in principle, eliminated some of the objectives, or some of the objections on the part of some people. Also, electronic music, by having been effective in a number of situations in television, through belly performances, through the uses for commercials, also as background music and drama, proved its worth, and somehow fought out a certain acceptance on the part by a large number of people in general audience, also in academia. Now, that much about the historical aspect of acceptability. Now, as far as the curriculum is concerned, for example, until recently, very recently, in this department, every student had to take in the second year of a Bachelor of Music program a course in electronic music, because the department thought it's good for them.
Mm-hmm.
Partly for the reason, possibly partly for the reason I mentioned, and partly for some other reasons which some other people would care to mention. Now, I and some of my colleagues felt that, again, as a result of some of our experience here, that might have been a bit going too much on the other direction, from very restricted so-called elitist acceptability. And I don't really like the word elitist, I'm kind of using that because it's in the air.
Mm.
But very restricted accessibility of the early days, the opposite, imposing this on students, whether they're interested or not, the pendulum swung in the other direction. Now, a few months ago, we moved towards the middle and we said, well, we have the studio, we feel that it's a good thing to have, especially for composers, and we very strongly advise composers to take a course in electronic music, but it's not compulsory for anyone any longer. And that's really a healthier situation, I feel, because it doesn't overburden the studio, and it really allows more time to those students who want to take that, while it doesn't really compel a young violinist student who doesn't really want to spend
yeah.
time there, but rather want to practice the Paganini caprices for 5 or 6 hours a day. Or somebody who want to read about Guillaume de Machaut. So that is a healthier situation. Now, the second aspect of the systematic pedagogic point you raised, Jim, whether I would care to put down my pedagogical ideas, I would codify them and so on. Well, I never really wrote a textbook on electronic music, but my colleague David Keane, as you know, has written a textbook on, or a book, which I think he uses also the textbook for in his classes, on the pedagogy and aesthetics of electronic music, and David has published other articles on that. So there also, you know, about the Pellegrino book, and there are lots of publications that contribute to the pedagogy of electronic music today, and they are very diverse, quite rightly so, because of the diversity of the hardware. My experience in electronic music is really confined to the mechanical machines of Hue, because mechanical electronic machines of Hue, and to some apparatus along the voltage controllers, the voltage control type. I work only very, very little with computers, and that was when I visited Bell Labs in 1961. So I don't think I'm the right person to write the comprehensive book on the pedagogy of electronic music. And certainly I would not want to impose my experience in interface on any student. What I would, however, emphasize, and I was grateful that you gave me the opportunity, I would emphasize the general principle that this man-machine interface situation in its manifold guises or manifold realizations with which electronic music in its many different forms constitute all these possibilities together or any part thereof is a potential very strong source for any composer, young, middle age, or even old, that that is could be and was for a number of people the source of great learning. And if I remember correctly, Ligeti, whom I heard in a panel session in Paris in one of the IRCAM symposia, spoke very much along these lines. He spoke about the pedagogical, the self-learning gains he experienced in the studio. I hope I remember him correctly.
Yeah, I think.
Do you have? I mean, may I ask that from you?
Sure.
Do you have this experience?
Right. I consider the nights spent in the electronic music studio I would echo what you said. It's certainly some of the most valuable and instructive times I've experiences I've ever had in terms of composition. And interestingly enough, I've been dealing with the computer project at U of T, and in a way it's a similar situation because it's as a basic naive, you know, you approach this situation that's totally new to you. And in a way, it's very similar to what I was doing 10 years ago when I first walked into an electronic music studio. And the atmosphere and the almost the electricity in the air is very much like it, you know, very much as I remember it then. And I think there's something about getting down there with maybe even the nature of the machines, that they were mechanical and that they were, you know, you had to hit them and kick them and
stuff. Much tactile contact.
Reinforcement there, yes. Yeah. It's interesting.
No, I didn't kick them. That's the only thing. I didn't do.
Tickle them.
Yes, right.
We should, before we run out of tape, we should touch on one a couple
There's
of other things.
More,
so. Oh, okay, good. What? Maybe you could make some general comments on what the future of the instruments is, if any, that you see for them.
Well, the situation today is very different from the time. I worked with these instruments. Today, I wouldn't think that these instruments can hold a candle to some of the generalized computer setups that exist at Stanford University or at IRCAM. I think the future of electronic music it lies much more in the direction of the computer than anywhere else. So in this sense, these machines are historical relics, in this sense. However, as recently as 1974, 6 years ago, I still used the special purpose tape recorder right here at Queen's University for the purpose of synchronizing some speech material which went into parts of La Tour Angèle. In fact, the whole La Tour Angèle speech material was synchronized by the special purpose tape recorder. And I still don't know of any other instrument that would have or could today give me that versatility than the special purpose tape recorder.
Mm-hmm.
I'll tell you why. If you would tell me, why don't you use a 16-channel tape, 2-inch tape or whatever? Well, I don't have experience with that. I didn't even work with a 4-channel tape. The largest number of channels on an Ampex or Scully for me was 2. And why? Because that tape was usable on the special purpose tape recorder, which was my synchronizing machine. Now, why don't I use, say, a half inch tape or a 1 inch tape or 2 inch tape for 8, 16, 32 channels? Well, I don't know whether I can edit and synchronize with the same kind of flexibility. With the special purpose tape recorder, it's terribly simple to change the phase relationship between tape A and tape B, which I want to synchronize. But tape A has two channels and tape B has two channels. Or I can take one channel on tape A and another one channel on tape B. Or I can change the phase relationships by just tugging a little bit on one tape. It takes me a half second flat. And I can set up a million different phase relationship between those two tapes by just pulling a little bit on the tape or adjusting the pulleys or whatever. And then I don't have to erase, I don't have to find the spot, I don't have to worry about synchronization, it's right then and there. Now multiply that by 2, by 3, by 4, by 5, and I don't know how one cuts a half inch tape or a 1 inch tape in a way one cuts a quarter inch tape. And by going back and forth between the two channel MPEX and the 20 channel special purpose tape recorder, which also operates with quarter inch tape, I mean, I had such an incredible flexible setup that in relatively little time, in hours, I could run dozens of experiments. I shudder thought having to do that with a half inch or 1 inch or 2 inch tape. You see the point? Yeah. So it means in some way, I still think that for people who use speech material, pre-recorded speech material as a compositional stratum, rather than speech material like Charles Dodge uses, where he actually, this is a different kind of use of speech material, very interesting, a subtle one. But I didn't go that way. I pre-recorded speech. I'm very much interested in how real life people's voice sound, pre-recorded and work with that. To me, even today, the most versatile instrument is something like a special purpose tape recorder to synchronize those tape materials. So in this sense, the special purpose tape recorder is not a historical relic to be put in a museum. But I do hope that we can keep it up to date, and I might or might not use it in another composition or a student of mine or somebody in 10, 15 years. So in this sense, this instrument could still be useful.
But that's the only one you can think of at the moment that has that category. I wondered if there were any others.
Well, look through the available commercial available machinery for various functions. I think probably his Cyton oscillator bank is outdated. I really feel that with today's synthesizers and sequencers and that machine with its static 24 or God knows how many oscillators, it is really outdated. Because those oscillators are not voltage controlled. Also, I feel probably his tone mixture generator is outdated. Also, I feel that his third filters, I don't think that instrument does anything more than what a commercial third filter does. So a few of his instruments, I think, are outdated. Now, the serial structure generator, also I feel the probably is outdated. Computers can do that. With a Sond or a Pauli, I'm not really familiar with, I think you better ask Paul Peterson or David about this. The spectrogram machine, again, which is a processor which works with pre-constructed material, this I wonder whether well, okay, one could think of an envelope generator, a programmable envelope generator, a multi-channel programmable envelope generator could perform that function, or perhaps even better. So if somebody has that, then fine, then. But this machine could still be quite useful if one doesn't have such a kind of fancy array of 24 programmable envelope controllers in sync.
Mm-hmm. Let me try a thought on you. We've been thinking about this, of course, for some time, and I think generally what you've said has corresponds to what we've decided, that the really most of the developments have been superseded by current technology. But there is something, I think that there's something valuable about the basic eccentricity of a lot of the design ideas that went into these instruments. He obviously was thinking in ways that nobody else was approaching the field. And I'm sort of gradually coming to the conclusion that it would be valuable just to keep four or five of the instruments, specific examples of the instrumental types, up and working. Just there's something that's very attractive to me, because it's so unique, and that with the application of semiconductor technology to the rest of electronic music, you walk into a store now and it's full of synthesizers, but they've all been designed by the same mind, basically, because as you know, if they've been taken over by bigger companies and things like that, the design, while their general purpose power is much greater, the things that they've eliminated, they've decided they're not important. They've all decided they're not important, and all of a sudden aren't available anymore. So, how would you react to that?
Well, I think it's a very good idea. I think to say that this or that instrument is outdated, but so is Newton outdated, it doesn't mean that Newton is forgotten. I think Hugh is a very important historical figure, and his instruments have great interest. Even those instruments which one would call outdated, because there are instruments today available that perform that function more economically or more versatile way. His instruments are very important because they show a certain phase in the history of development of electronic music instrumentation. In this sense, I fully agree with you. I would love to see Hugh's instruments kept in a working order and as a historical documentation, if nothing else. And there could be that there might be a composer who say, well, I just want to work with these historical models because for whatever reason.
Yeah.
But I would like to add that these are very delicate machines, because many of them were either prototypes or second or third realizations in the shop somewhere up at NRC, and they break down quite frequently and they can be noisy. So the question what to do with that as a collection of instruments by Hugh put together in one place, put back in reasonable working order, what to do with it? Who should be allowed to use it?
Mm-hmm.
Make sure that these things are not used as toys in a science museum.
That's something that's good to us. That's a situation we would rather not. I mean, I don't know whether I want thousands of school kids going by them every Saturday afternoon.
They won't survive probably the third Saturday.
No.
They should be only used by, back to the old elitist point of view, people who know how to deal with them.
Well,
but visually they're
interesting
them also.
Approach them with proper respect.
Yes.
Yes.
People could go to them in the museum with the traditional glass case or the chain around them and look at them and listen to tapes perhaps.
Yes. Well,
I hate going into museums and looking at instruments that are, you know, are sitting behind the glass deteriorating because nobody's playing.
Well, there are different ways you see, I would like to come back to the children. It's very important that the children should have more than just looking at those things under the on the glass, because after all, among those children there might be another Hugh.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very important that there should be this electric contact between that child and this instrument. And so I'm thinking of various modalities of conveying the excitement and the ingenuity and the genius that is embodied in these instruments to this single child or those very few children that have to be reached, or perhaps many children reached at a different level. So quite a few years ago, McGill, the linguistics department asked me whether I would want to contribute to a course in linguistics, which they set up in a modular way. Every module approach linguistics from a certain point of view, and they were interested how I worked on Cento. And somebody came over from the linguistics department and made a videotape while I was sitting in the studio and working with the machines and explaining how these machines work. So I think a tape like that, or somebody else, or several people working with Hughes machines and having an audio track going at the same time, with video track, together with a machine that would be just sitting there, a film, the machine, the soundtrack, could give an idea to these children really how these machines sounded, what these machines can do.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good idea. One of the aims, or one of the objectives of the project, was to develop tools that, or put the information in such a format that it would be, you know, useful for public school stuff. One of the main impetuses for starting the thing in the first place was I was doing my course for music teachers at U of T, and they were looking for information that was Canadian based on electronic music, and of course there wasn't any. And then you're suddenly confronted with this apparent dichotomy. You have one of the main pioneers in the field, you know, and then absolutely no information about it. So that was one of the reasons that the thing got started in the first place.
The whole exploration project?
Yeah.
Which course is that, Jim?
It's electronic music for the people who are doing type A music. It's their certification for public school music.
Do they actually go into a studio?
Yeah, we have a small studio, two synths and an arp and a couple of tape recorders, and so there's a band pass filter.
That's in the Faculty of Music?
Yeah. Well, no, it's in the Faculty of Education, the studio itself.
Oh, I see. The Faculty of Education, right.
Yeah. And that was one of the impetuses for the project in the first place.
Well, where did you study again?
At York University.
York?
Yeah.
You have a studio there. Did you work in a studio there?
Yeah, I studied.
With whom did you study there?
During the second year I was there, Richard Teitelbaum was teaching. And the next year I took a course with David Rosenblum.
Yes.
And that year, James Tenney he updated
yes.
the department. So
is Tanya still there?
Yeah, he's on sabbatical this year. He'll be
yes.
back again. So I studied with the three of them. It was quite a rounded education.
Yes.
yeah.
And also I'm working at the computer installation at University of Toronto now.
Yes.
So that's it's an entirely different
yes.
terrain again.
Yes.
It's funny they're using composers in the same way that Hugh used you.
Yeah, Jim and I are both participating in that.
So I guess it's a well established research technique.
You're
getting picked. Yes. Well, do you think we covered?
I think we've hit most of the things we wanted to.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So thank you very much for talking.
No, a pleasure. Thanks for asking these questions. I very seldom the opportunity to talk about that.